and Mental Hygiene in Long Island City will speak to us about risk among youth with discordant sexual identity and sexual behavior, representative data from 2005 to 2009 New York City Youth Risk Behavior Surveys. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. Good afternoon. So as we know, adolescence is a period of is a formative period during which not only sexual experimentation but identity development takes place. And in addition to the usual personal and social challenges for adolescents during this time, those with same-sex partners may face additional stresses related to rejection, isolation, verbal abuse, physical violence, bullying, and poor access to confidential health care. There have been several studies that have documented higher rates of sexual and substance use risk behaviors among youth who report same-sex partners. But there are subsets, and not all subsets are the same. For instance, we've seen that youth that report both male and female partners report riskier behaviors. And it's important to identify the most vulnerable subsets of the adolescent population with same-sex partners. Some population-based surveys of adolescents capture multiple measures of sexual orientation, those being attraction, experience, or reported sex of partners, and sexual identity. And the sexual risk that is measured in these studies of lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth depends on the dimension of sexual orientation that is used. As we know, measures of sexual orientation are often not concordant and should not be used interchangeably. Studies of LGB youth have treated sexual attraction, behavior, and identity as isolated constructs, or they've grouped youth based on one or another measure of sexual orientation. So, for instance, bisexuals could be identified or defined as those who are reporting a bisexual identity or partners of both sexes. Few studies have examined risky behaviors among youth while taking into account interactions or combinations of the different measures of sexual orientation. So our objective was to determine if youth with sexual identity that was discrepant from the reported sex of partners are at an increased risk of adverse sexual risk outcomes. Specifically, we used population-level data with concurrent measures of sexual identity and sex of partners to determine the prevalence of concordant and discordant identity behavior and to characterize sexual risks among these groups. To do this, we used the New York City Youth Risk Behavior Survey, or YRBS, which is the city sample within the CDC's National Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, and the system assesses trends in health risk behaviors among high school students via in-school self-administered anonymous surveys, and the survey is done every 2 years. A two-stage cluster sample design accounts for high school and then classroom and produces a representative sample of New York City public high school students. We combined 3 years of the survey. Overall, we had over 29,000 students that participated and an overall response rate of 72%. So the YRBS every year includes several questions on sexual experiences and sexual identity. Sexual experience is gauged as, have you ever had sexual intercourse? Sex of partners through asking, during your life, with whom have you had sexual contact? And sexual identity, the question is framed as, which of the following best describes you? With response categories of heterosexual or straight, gay or lesbian, bisexual or not sure. And then the YRBS asks about several sexual risk behaviors, including age at first intercourse, number of lifetime sex partners, number of partners in the last 3 months, condom use at last sex, and the use of alcohol or drugs at last sex. We constructed two identity behavior groups based on 9 permutations of sexual identity and the sex of lifetime contacts. The concordant group consisted of 3 subgroups, youth who identified as straight and had only opposite sex partners, youth who identified as gay or lesbian and had only same sex partners, and bisexual identified youth who had both male and female partners. And the discordant group consisted of 6 subgroups, straight identified youth with only same sex partners or both male and female partners, gay or lesbian identified youth with only opposite sex partners or both male and female partners, and bisexual identified youth with only opposite sex partners or only same sex partners. We calculated the weighted prevalence of concordant and discordant identity behavior separately for males and females, and the weighted prevalence of risk characteristics according to concordance and discordance. And since we have seen in New York City that youth with both male and female partners are riskier than those who report only opposite sex or only same-sex partners, and may be driving some of the high estimates of risk behaviors that we found, we also examined the prevalence of risk when excluding behaviorally bisexual adolescents. And then finally, we looked at the associations between discordance and sexual risk behaviors for females. Data were weighted to adjust for school and student non-response, and we used Sudan software for all of the analyses. So again, we had just over 29,000 students participating in 3 years of the survey. Of those, about 25,000 answered the question on sexual intercourse. Just over half of males reported that they'd ever had sex, and this was 42% for females. 94% of males reported the sex of their partners and a sexual identity and were included in further analyses. This was 96% for females. And of the males, 7% reported either a male partner or both male and female partners. Of females, 13% reported female partners or both male and female partners. This table shows male concordance and discordance. Sexual behavior is down the left-hand column, and sexual identity groups are across the table. And I've highlighted in gray where identity and behavior are discordant, and highlighted in red font where discordance was particularly high. So for males reporting only male partners, 66% reported a straight identity, and 6% reported being bisexual. Of those reporting both male and female partners, 14% reported being straight, and another 5% reported a gay sexual identity. And when I combined all of the gray cells on this slide, the prevalence of identity and behavior discordance for males was 3.8%. For females, similar patterns, although a higher degree of discordance. For those reporting male partners, 4% reported a bisexual identity. For those reporting female partners only, 66% said they were straight, and about 11% said they were bisexual. Of those reporting both male and female partners, fully a quarter said they were straight, and another 7% reported a lesbian sexual identity. And the prevalence of identity and behavior discordance for females was about 10%. Here we're looking at male sexual behaviors. The light gray bars are for males with concordance, the dark gray for males with discordance. Asterisks represent where there's a significant difference between the two groups. And for males, there wasn't that much difference between the two groups, except that those with concordance were more likely to report two or more partners in the last 3 months, and males with discordance were less likely than those with concordance to report using a condom at last sex. For females, the pattern was different, where we saw differences in the two groups for just about every variable that we examined. Females with discordance were about twice as likely as those with concordance to report an age at first sex that was at or under age 13. Five or more lifetime partners, two or more partners in the last 3 months, and the use of alcohol or drugs at last sex. However, when we took out females who had both male and female partners, this association went away. And then finally, we looked at the association between female discordance and sexual risk behaviors. Here we have four multivariate models, and we can see from looking at the first row of this table that females with discordance compared to those with concordant identity behavior were 2.4 times more likely to report a younger age at first sex, 1.6 times more likely to report five or more partners in the last 3 months, and two or more partners in the last, no, so five or more lifetime partners and two or more partners in the last 3 months, and almost two times more likely than the concordant females with concordance to report the use of alcohol or drugs at last sex, while controlling for some other characteristics such as race and ethnicity and age at first sex. So there's some limitations to our analysis. One is that homeless youth and youth in alternative schools were not included in these surveys, so we may be missing populations that have higher proportions of persons with same-sex partners and different risk profiles. Sexual intercourse was not defined, and neither was sexual contact, nor was there a referent period given for that question. However, considering that it is a survey of adolescents, we can assume that risk behaviors were quite recent, as the time to have accumulated these experiences was pretty short. And finally, and importantly, cross-sectional data do not capture changes in identity or behavior over time, so we don't know if these risk behaviors would have changed as if and when identity would have been established or changed. And then finally, same-sex behavior and conclusion. Same-sex behavior among adolescents is not uncommon. For males and females together, it was about 10%. Similarly, discordant sexual identity behavior is not uncommon, and it's more than twice as prevalent among females than males. Sexual risk-taking was higher among females with discordant versus concordant identity behavior. And a substantial proportion of all males and females report the use of alcohol and or drugs before or during their last sexual encounter, which has important messages or implications around messages for this risk behavior. Other implications are, and we all know this very well, that providers must ask about the sex of partners when assessing risk. And although establishing an adolescent sexual identity may not usually be seen as necessary, we suggest that ascertaining it may help to further identify those at an increased risk of STD, including HIV. Since LGBT youth seek services, primary care, and specialty care services from the same pediatricians and family doctors that non-LGBT youth do, it's important for providers to utilize available resources and referrals to help provide the most sensitive and culturally appropriate care. Addressing identity and coming out issues is important for those developing sexuality and sexual health curricula for teens, and continued research to inform the approach for advancing the sexual health framework that is a priority for CDC and other public health stakeholders. This kind of research can really help that. But it's important in this research to include a minimum set of standardized measures of sexual orientation, particularly in large health surveys. And I would like to acknowledge our collaborators in our Division of Epidemiology, and of course everybody who participates in the YRBS.
So we will entertain our last set of questions, but before we do that, I'd just like to thank the fabulous array of speakers that we had today. You really showed some cutting edge work. That is just leading the field. I'd also like to thank you as an audience. You were fantastic, and I think we've had some stimulating discussions, so please continue your question.
I'll try to be stimulating.
Yes, only if you are.
My name is Rob Yeager. I'm from the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm wondering, given the growing number of youth identifying as transgender, genderqueer, or not identifying a gender, why they don't seem to have been included either as the respondents or the sex partners?
Yeah, so some of the YRBS questions that we ask, even in our local YRBS, have to be ones that are included on the national level. We have the option to include some that don't have to be in the YRBSS. But we have to always keep the survey at 99 questions, and for the purposes of trends, we can't throw some out. And of course, we can only ask out. I pretty much listed all the sexual behavior questions that we have. So there are so many that have to do with physical activity and violence, and so it's just not permissible, particularly considering the low prevalence that we might expect for those sorts of questions. Transgender, transsexual.
Low numbers of transgender or genderqueer people, or low prevalence of
transgender individuals.
Jacques Swami from New Orleans. I want to submit this to you and ask what you think about that. In survey research, people just answer questions because they were asked. They may not have thought about that before, but they're answering that because they have been asked to answer the questions. So I think some of the discordant behavior should be interpreted in light of youth may have been just answering questions without really reporting accurately what they know be their behavior. What do you think of that, and what do you think a part of that might be in interpreting the discorders particularly?
Yes, sure. So, of course, this is self-administered and it's anonymous, and we can't go back and ask any questions that seem questions about responses that don't seem quite right. There may be, you know, these are sensitive things that we're asking about, and there's some social desirability bias, so obviously things may not be accurate, and we just have to accept what it is. The one good thing is that we do look at trends from year to year, and in general, when we don't see them changing, which has been the case, we can assume that at least we're seeing something that is reliable, if not the most valid.
And we'll take one more question. Thank you.
Hi, Cameron Estrich from UIC. Thank you so much for presenting this data. It was a really fascinating analysis
for me.
I was wondering, I feel like some of this was getting at the effects of minority stress and sort of the effects of having a sexual identity and having sexual behavior or attraction that don't necessarily match up. But I also think that it's possible that involuntary sexual contact might be kind of mixing up the results a little. Do you think there's any way, given the data set and the constraints thereof, to separate out any discordance of sexual behavior and sexual attraction based on involuntary sexual contact?
Yes, so there are two questions that I did not include in these analyses. One has to do with dating violence, and one has to do with forced sexual contact, a history of. And we could certainly look at these things by persons who report any of those and see if there's some differences between them and the general group.
So thank you again.
Thank you.